Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Mixed Mental Arts inside a room with green screen, which is very exciting, although I probably just sort of ruined the illusion because right now they're not seeing the green screen. They're seeing some sort of awesome dojo background, right?
Yes. Yeah. And Hunter, may I say that Mixed Mental Arts is about breaking the illusion. So,
so there you go. So Toto just pulled back the curtain.
Yeah.
But I think in general in Hollywood special effects, you're not supposed to be like, by the way, this liquid metal Terminator isn't actually really here.
It's just me. I'm strapped to the green screen.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no big deal.
There's a man with ping pong balls on his face.
Yeah. I'm not flying. I'm just hanging from wires here. There's a lot of wires that I'm hanging from. And
spoiler alert within the movie. Anyway, so yeah, ladies and gentlemen, this green screen room is made entirely possible by Andrew Hunt, your fellow mixed mental artist.
Yes.
You know, we met doing stand-up.
Yep.
You know, one of the things that I did when I first moved out here was under the, you know, careful tutelage and protection of Emperor Callan.
Mm-hmm.
I did some stand-up. And, you know, then, I mean, we saw each other a bunch and then mm-hmm. sort of lost touch and then reconnected.
Well, you just reminded me. Okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
One of my favorite things that we used to talk about was Web 2.0 because it was like pretty new and we were like, oh, this Web 2.0 is going to be great.
Well, it also was funny because I also remember like that was such a specific period of time because Facebook had come out, but everybody was like it hadn't taken over yet. It was still MySpace. And so I just remember that was the period of stand-up where Dane Cook was huge and everybody was like, dude, Dane Cook has like a million friends on MySpace. And he was like the first person to do that. And, you know, that was all fascinating. Wow, that really.
It was an incredible time. You know, it was an incredible time because so many of the tools that we use, like without even thinking about them today, were like just, you know, around and certain people knew how to use them and certain people didn't. And certain people like Dane Cook literally showed us what was possible.
Right.
Like you didn't even know what was possible with MySpace until Dane Cook came out.
And that's really the speed of cultural evolution in action, right? Both the evolution of the technology, but then the evolution of how you use the technology, right? And so, you know, I think this is a sort of how I like to think about this, which I think is a sort of fun way to think about it, is that, you know, there was a new ecological niche that opened up, which was made possible by MySpace and all these other technologies. And Dane Cook ran in there and he exploited that ecological niche.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and then there have been more and more people who have exploited, you know, Rogan exploited the podcast niche. He ran in there and, you know, really explored that. And, you know, these new ecological niches keep opening up and people exploit them. They dominate them. They take advantage of it. And it works in exactly the same way as, you know, an organism would, right? Where there's like, you know, there's an island. There are no finches there. One finch gets blown across the ocean, ends up there. Boom.
Yeah.
Finches come to dominate those islands.
Definitely. Now, so I've been listening to Rogan for years since his podcast came out, and I really loved it because it really showed the potential of what a podcast, the power that a podcast could really have in bringing people together. Rogan's been so great in choosing his guests, and there's a number of interviews that he did with people where he really went deep with them for 3 hours. If you listen to the podcast that he did, it was years ago, but it was with Melissa Etheridge.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, when they talk about cancer and they go deep about it for three hours, I mean, that's like a free form kind of conversation that they have that you get to be a real fly on the wall. And these are things for me that I didn't really, you know, realize was possible until Rogan started doing it.
Well, it also wasn't possible, right? I mean, you know, 3 hours is a lot of video content.
Mm-hmm.
And then to be able to distribute that 3 hours or audio content, to be able to distribute those 3 hours over the internet is, you know, that's not a thing that was technologically possible, you know, 10, 15 years. Like, I mean, you know, Dane Cook could not have taken 3 hours of video content and just sort of put it up on the web every single day to stream at decent speeds because, you know, the capacity simply didn't exist.
Yeah.
So, you know, the technology keeps on making new adjacent possibles possible.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I've been thinking about, you know, which I think is not obvious to everyone, but the, you know, what happens as more and more of this technology becomes possible? Well, essentially, you now have the tools where everyone gets a voice and where it really is a global conversation. And, you know, when that happens, inevitably, you know, is how much is you're not going to be able to rely on intuitions of authority or like whose voice counts more than other people's. Everyone's voice counts. Mm-hmm. So therefore, what you have to do is that, you know, you have to, how are you going to settle disagreements? Like, what is the authority going to be? And I think the point is that the authority should be the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, I think, a large part of what mixed mental arts is about is sort of midwifing that in.
Well, that's one of the things when we got together and you started talking about idea sex.
Yeah,
and you started
talking
about, you know, the group dynamic. And,
right.
What is it that you say? It's the wisdom of crowds.
Yeah, the wisdom of crowds.
You talk about that a lot. And I mean, that really is so valid. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that the wisdom of crowds is really like the democracy that we all kind of
that's right.
wish we had.
Well, and the point is that the tools exist now,
uh-huh.
right? Like there's no reason... You know, right now, is there any reason why you couldn't have a global conversation where everybody is like, you know, here's everybody out. We all try and understand our own cultural baggage. We try to pick apart what's going on with the other person. And we just have awesome idea sex all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why that isn't possible. And in fact, if you look at a lot of what's going on in the Mixed Mental Arts Facebook group, sometimes it gets emotionally heated, emotionally, you know, dramatic, but... You know, there is a little pocket there of what the entire internet could be.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing with the wisdom of crowds, too, is that, like, you know, we store this cultural baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And when opposing views interrupt our cultural baggage, we go berserk.
Yeah.
And we go, no, 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 that can't be true. But then when you have, you know, the wisdom of crowds saying,
that's
well,
right.
there is a validity to this other perspective that you may not be aware of. It's that thing that you talk about on Mixed Mental Arts a lot where you go, let's see who can hold two opposing views and be able to have the conversation between
that's right.
both sides and learn something from both and mm-hmm. not get stuck in our own cultural baggage that we've been raised with.
That's right. And crucially, a lot of that comes down to, I think, social pressure. So, you know, there's usually, I mean, there people have these intuitions around debate, right? And that we're going to debate things out. But the whole point is that part of what the democratization of everybody getting a microphone makes possible is that now you can put social pressure on each other, right? And rotating social pressure where it's suddenly like, dude, you've lost the plot on this point. Dude, you're off on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're able to essentially repeatedly stage interventions on various members of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a reason why, you know, an intervention is like a big group of people, mm-hmm. right? They get around you and they're like, we love you, but you're out of touch with reality.
Yeah.
And so... Anyway, I mean, I think that's the point is Rogan said something which I think was spot on, which is just that, you know, we're really in this adolescent phase of the internet in the sense that the tools are here, but the culture has not yet caught up.
Yeah.
And our job is to help catch the culture up, and we do that by having conversations like this.
Absolutely.
And what I think was interesting, you know, you've referenced this conversation that we had at the Coral Tree Cafe. And, you know, you and I reached in that sort of intervening period between us doing stand-up together when Dane Cook, you know, got 1 million followers on MySpace and sort of blew everyone's mind and catching up in the last few months, we've reached very similar conclusions, but from totally different paths.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was reading all the science and reading all the Joe Henrich cultural evolution, the Holy Trinity of cultural evolution, John Haidt, Joe Henrich, and David Sloan Wilson. And for you,
mm-hmm.
it's come from, and I'm going to just say right now before you say his name, that this is going to make one person in particular, one mixed mental artist, very, very happy, and that's at Maz77A on Twitter, because for months and months, he's been trying to get me to engage with these ideas. So go ahead and say it.
My main man, the 101-year-old walking, talking scientist, love machine, Jock Fresco.
He's a love machine?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It gives you, he gives you, I got to say, when I met him,
yeah,
you know, he gives you nothing but love. Yeah. I mean, he truly understands that, like, you know, you're a product of your environment, you're a product of your culture, and he holds you with no judgments.
Right.
And he'll sit and he'll listen to you and he'll kind of, you know, give you his wisdom. And in that, at least for me, in the wisdom that he gave me, it was a big wake-up call to the potential that was living inside me.
Mm-hmm.
And not just me, and anyone, and the untapped right. potential. And again, when you went on Rogan and you started talking about these ideas and unpacking these ideas of cultural baggage and things like that, I was like, God damn it, Hunter, you're right. Yeah. You know. And, you know, to have these types of conversations, I think it's healthy. I think it opens you up. It forces you to take a look at your past and go, oh, well, why do I hate math so much? Why don't I like reading aloud in front of other people? Why,
right.
you know? And you start to take a look at yourself. You go, oh, well, there's a lot of things that happened along the way that, you know, pushed me in a positively reinforced one direction or another.
Right.
And, you know.
So let's talk about the love machine, Jacques Fresco, the 101-year-old love machine. Right there, by the way, is Brian Callen's dream is to be at 101, still described as
referenced
a love
as a
machine.
Love machine. Yeah. Well, listen, he's got some fast twitch muscles that are going to keep him loving for a long time.
This reminds me of actually my one of my roommates, Joe Flood. He never did particularly well in Spanish. And, you know, he would constantly, the one phrase is he would describe himself as a love machine and then translate it into this bizarre Spanglish where he would say, el machín de amor. Because basically he knew the word amor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, so let's talk about El Machin de Amor.
El Machin de Amor. Okay, so.
So, because what, here, I'll tell you what I know of him, okay. right? So, you know, I was like, oh, Jacques Fresco. And then I sort of knew about the Venus Project. And then I saw these sort of like Tomorrowland design drawings of like, you know, cool looking like space domes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. And he's like sort of, that's my understanding, is that he's like an architect who like makes cool looking future spaces. That was my understanding. But then I had a conversation with you and I found out that there's a lot more going on there.
Yeah. Well, you know, part of the history of Jock, when I had, you know, I've sat with him many times. I went out and I visited him and I, you know, we shot some interviews and stuff. He started around the age of 13 in 1929 with the Great Depression, looking around going, wow, you know, it's not that we don't have resources mm-hmm. available to, you know, make all these goods and services and house and clothe and feed all the people.
Right.
It just seems that we don't have the purchasing power to buy what's in all the stores. And, you know, I have to say, before I even met Jock, I watched the Zeitgeist movies, and it was in Zeitgeist Addendum, which was Peter Joseph's second film, which is what really turned me on to Jacques. And I said, oh man, I got to go meet that guy. He's, you know, he's old. I think at the time he was like 96.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I'm saying to myself, well, I got to go meet this guy. So, so I called the Venus Project and I talked to Roxanne Meadows and I got on the plane and I went out there and they were kind enough to put me up and, you know, I stayed on the property. They have a 21-acre research laboratory in Venus, Florida, mm-hmm. hence the name, the Venus Project.
Right.
So I got to spend time with them. I got to live on the property for a little bit and just kind of get really familiar with the philosophy, mm-hmm. With the books that they like you to read, that they recommend. And, you know, the main thing that Jock really unlocked in me is that there's no such thing as smart or dumb in the way that you think of it. Environment shapes your behavior always. Free will, not really. You don't really have free will when you think about all the environmental stimulus around you and the way that you react to it and the way that anybody reacts to
right.
it. And these ideas, you know, obviously it's the foundation of his work, but these ideas really made me take a good look inside and go, oh, okay, well, if it really is just that the amount of time that you spend working in certain areas, then it's, you know, it's the 10,000 hours thing. I mean, that's an easy way to put it, is that if you want to get good at something, you just got to put in the time.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, you know, there's this sort of three pieces there, right? the intelligence piece sounds an awful lot like the straight A conspiracy framed in words that are almost exactly the same as the straight A conspiracy.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
I'm like, okay, great. So, and I mean, I think this, by the way, sort of gets to a larger point about innovation, right? Mm-hmm. There's, yeah. you know, so much of the sort of the genius myth idea of intelligence is that like, nobody had thought of this before, and then one person figured it out.
Yeah.
And when you look at, you know, this is part of the point that Joe Henrich makes, this is part of the opening of the straight A conspiracy, what you come to find is that it is really that pyramid of hobbits, and that at a certain point, enough hobbits have piled up that a bunch of people independently reinvent these ideas. So you have Leibniz is talking about this, Newton is talking about this. So, you know, that's sort of the all of these ideas are there, they're out there, right? And different people puzzle them together and piece them together in different orders. And then it's just clearer and clearer expressions of these ideas. So there's that. Yep.
And even Fresco, I want to make clear that Fresco will tell you, he goes, hey, my work is based off the work of other people. You know, like there were people around me in the 20s and 30s and 40s that knew this stuff. And there were a lot of books that were in the library that weren't necessarily in the school systems, but there were a lot of books around and there was a lot of information available that had these exact same ideas. So so I don't think Jock goes around saying, hey, I'm the only guy who knows this shit. So he is a guy saying, I really did my best to try to pull it all together into a social system that we could transition into over a period of time in the near future.
That pulling together is idea sex, right?
Yes.
You know, that Newton's
unprotected, raw,
raw idea sex. That's why, because that's the point is that he's an idea love machine, right?
He really is.
He really is an idea love machine. So, and you know, what greater thing is there to be than an idea love machine? Well, you can also be a physical love machine. In fact, you can be both. That is a mixed metal artist aspires to it all, at least. So I think there's that. And then there's that second piece, right, where he's talking about, you know, culture, right? And he's talking about how, you know, culture shapes behavior, that social intelligence, that social pressure, which is all very much the same thing as what we're getting from the science in terms of Henrich, in terms of Dacher Keltner, in terms of social intelligence being humanity's superpower. So same thing there, right?
Same exact idea.
And I think what's interesting, part of what you told me, was how he came to that idea, because a large part of it was this experience of leaving his own culture and going and spending time in...
He went to a place called the Island of Tuamotu, which I don't believe is around anymore. The island itself is around, but it's not called Tuamotu anymore.
Okay.
I can't remember what
the island didn't sink
is.
Or something.
It sunk.
Oh shit. Tuamotu, no. Where are you?
We'll have to look it up. I don't know where Tuamotu is, but I remember in one of my conversations he was saying it's not Tuamotu anymore, but that was the island. So he lived with these people, and on this island, one of the things that he was studying, he went there to study their behavior, and it was so interesting to him because it was untouched by technology, but it was an island of abundance when it comes to housing, shelter, and they didn't really wear much clothing on the island. He indicated that there were no peeping Toms on the island, because they weren't raised that way. All the kids were raised naked together.
Right.
You had
naked and unafraid.
Naked and unafraid, baby.
Sounds like a much more fun show.
Yeah. And he said one of the coolest things is that, you know, some people would fish and some people would cook and some people, but it was never like, you know, hey, you owe me a buck. Here's some, it was whoever was hungry ate, because it was an island of abundance when it came to food and shelter. And when it came to technology, they had the technology of, you know, up until the day, you know, so they had like tools and things like that, but they didn't have modern day technological, you know, advancement in the way that we think of it today. So when he was there, it was in the 50s. So you can imagine the technology that we had in the 50s.
Yeah.
And this was an island that had seen nothing. He lived there for about 6 months. And he took a lot of what he, you know, learned about social behavior from these wonderful people.
Yep. And so, you know, I kind of wish, I mean, there are two things that I know that a lot of people out there will be thinking. Man, this sounds a lot like the sort of stuff that Chris Ryan talks about on Tangentially Speaking, you know, and just the ways in which hunter-gatherer, that experience is misrepresented. And you know that these are people who have a functioning society, and that's because they're living you know, in harmony with, I think often when you hear this stuff said, that's, you know, people talk about being in harmony with nature, but it's also that they're living in harmony with human psychology, right? Yeah. In harmony with human hardware and how it's supposed to operate. Mm-hmm. So there's that. The other one that I'm reminded of too, which I think is so funny, is Sebastian Younger has this great book, Tribe. And one of the things that he quotes in there is Ben Franklin talking about how all these white people would go and, you know, say they would be kidnapped by Indians, or they would like go and live among the Indians. And then as soon as they would like rescue them and try and bring them back to civilization, they were like, no, I want to go back to living in that sort of, you know, hunter-gatherer indigenous way, because it's a much more satisfying experience. And there is that sense of embeddedness and community, and everybody is appreciated and valued. And, yeah, there's just a lot there. But so, again, you know, to make kintsugi, you see these same patterns repeating. All of these, there's a lot of these voices that are saying this, and part of how we midwife is to connect those dots and say, hey, guys, many people are saying the same thing in different ways. Mm-hmm. So that's the first two.
Right.
And then we have this third one,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the third one is for the life of me. But I think what was the third one? So
Well, it's environment shapes behavior.
Yeah.
You are a product of your culture, whether...
Oh, the third one is free will. I remember this now.
Oh, you know, you're raised to believe that you're an individual with individual ideas. And you are, but you are also someone who is, you know, if you're driving to work in the morning, you get hit by a car, which literally I saw that happen right in front of me the other day. And mm-hmm. I'm going, where's the free will in that?
Yeah.
You know, you're sitting there, you're in your car, and somebody just smacks into you at a red light.
Yeah.
Where's the free will in that?
Well, but also, you know, I mean, I think the free will is a particularly Western obsession, mm-hmm. right? Because it's sort of like, well, it's a particularly Western obsession because it's like, you know, free will, intuitions of liberty. Mm-hmm. And then also individuality. Mm-hmm. And, you put those two together and it's like, oh, free will. Let's talk about free will, mm-hmm. right? And free will is just, I mean, I think the bigger thing of free will, because I tended to come at this from a practical standpoint, is free will is just a colossal waste of time. Mm-hmm. Like, who's worried about free will, mm-hmm. right? Like, doesn't, you know, thinking about it or worrying about do I have or do I not have free will, mm-hmm. it's pretty ridiculous. The real, I think, you know, and also in terms of the free will thing, in practice, people become so defensive and upset about the idea of having free will or not having free will that they're not looking, they're not reflecting at, like, okay, what did I pick up from my culture? What is the weird baggage that I picked up? And I think that most of the way that you progress your own life and the most of the way that you get better is by unpacking as much of your own baggage and retraining your own elephant as much as you can so that you can have better habits. Mm-hmm.
In matters of free will like this, you know, there's a sense of relaxation that occurs when you kind of submit and go, okay, listen, I'm going to go in this direction. I'm going to be a stand-up comic. I'm going to try jiu-jitsu. I'm going to do something in my life. And the result, you don't know what the result is going to, and that's right. Kind of the point, you know, you can go a certain direction when you believe really steadfast to this idea of free will. It's kind of like, well, I didn't accomplish it because I fucked up bad.
You make it about you.
You do. You blame yourself and you can beat yourself up for certain results.
Yep.
In certain causalities, you can literally be in a position where you go, oh, that's my fault. And when you kind of tend to look at the world a little bit differently through the way that, you know, Jock proposes, I think it's a lot easier to be kinder to oneself.
Yeah.
You don't hold yourself to this type of like unrealistic standard.
Yep. Well, and crucially, you know, just to connect that with the science, because that's the vocabulary that I know. And also a lot of people are sort of... the only authority for a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. It's the only one they'll trust. This is called the fundamental attribution error. Mm-hmm. So it is that humans have this cognitive bias towards internalizing something, right? So, you know, Katie and I hear this all the time, right? We hear all the time, oh, he's just lazy, or, oh, she's a, you know, she's a good student, you know, she's this kind of person. And so it all becomes internalized as like, oh, you think it's this kind of person, and you're not looking at the situational factors. And really, what does it mean to be lazy? Lazy means that you don't have the motivation, right? And motivation is that you don't feel the right way. You don't have the right kind of feelings about this particular subject. And that's why you are demotivated, right? A lazy person is a demotivated person. It's not that they're a person without motivation, or that they have a motivation to actively avoid the thing. And I think that this is a good moment to segue into how your environment shaped you.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And specifically the environment of your educational experience.
Yeah, I went to a relatively small private school in LA, and it was, you know, I was always told that if you're here, you're smart. It's a good school. You got in, you know. And in about, you know, I started off in kindergarten. I was in the highest reading group. In first grade, I was in the lowest reading group, and I couldn't figure out why. But around that time, 6 or 7 years old, my parents also started seeing that I was upset that I wasn't in the highest reading group. So they took me to UCLA Medical Center, and they ran some tests, and I remember the types of tests. And I look back as an adult, and I go, well, that was stupid. Those were stupid tests. But that's not how you tell the intelligence. But I was diagnosed with ADD and dyslexia and all that stuff. Funny that when you start feeling upset about you know, being demoted, that's around the time I also started developing the signs of dyslexia. No signs of dyslexia prior, but after that event, you know, that's when I really started getting nervous to read out in the out loud and, you know, all this stuff. And it was, you don't think of it as painful. You just think of it as, oh, you have learning disabilities. And everyone around you, your parents and your school teachers and the doctors at UCLA, they're going, oh, well, you have learning disabilities. You have ADD, right. You have dyslexia, so it's okay, you know?
So you're constantly being told a story about yourself by the people around you.
Absolutely.
And then that shapes how you're then interpreting reality, because right. You're interpreting it all through other people's stories about Andrew.
Yeah, and right? Lucky for me that I was also positively reinforced as a creative.
Right.
So they go, oh, you're very creative.
Right.
You have hyperactive ADD and you have dyslexia. Good thing you're creative. So.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is why we wrote The Straight A Conspiracy.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, and I think there are important things to realize here. One, like so often people think that children are passive agents. But young Andrew notices that something has changed between kindergarten and first grade in terms of his reading group. And he's thinking and he's trying to make sense of that, right? And then what happens?
How does this happen to me?
Right.
Yeah.
And crucially, you know, humans, all humans, you know, this figure that I keep on referencing from Joe Henrich's The Secret of Our Success, right? You know, human, toddler, chimp, orangutan, right? You know, our causal intelligence, our ability to figure out why things happen is worse than a chimp's. But our social intelligence is off the charts. So young Andrew can't figure out why he's gotten demoted.
Right.
Right.
Young Andrew's confused. And so young Andrew gets all this like reinforcement of, well, you have learning disabilities. That's the answer.
From people with social power. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
You know, these professors at UCLA, these very impressive, fancy people and all of that.
Yep.
And so he gets the message.
They tried giving me reading glasses that weren't really glass because I didn't have any sight problems. They gave me a pair of glasses that would make the words bolder. appear bolder. By the time I was in fifth grade, I literally rejected school. I literally started getting C's, D's, and F's, and that went on all the way through high school.
Well, because what did you learn? What did you understood from your community? What did your tribe taught you?
That I had learning disabilities and that I was creative. Good thing I was a pretty good athlete.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like all bad.
Yeah.
It was just like, oh, well, you have this one little handicap and it involves reading and, you know.
And this thing is not for you.
Right. And so I was kind of like, okay, school's not for me.
Right.
And I actually, along the way, I would make up other reasons why I didn't like school. And, you know, when you're young, it's hard to articulate to an adult or to teachers and say, no, you're fucking wrong. Okay. Right. I'm just fine. I just need a little bit more time reading out loud and I'm going to be as good as anybody in this class.
That's right.
Which, you know, ultimately is how I solved the problem. I don't have dyslexia anymore. I can read out loud. I can read pages and pages and pages out loud because I think I've spent more time reading out loud than your normal person because of what, you know, is just an insecurity. I had an insecure. I'd start sweating. I wouldn't like to, you know, and going into the entertainment industry, it's tough enough to go on an audition with, you know, with people in LA and all this stuff, you know, it's tough enough. And then you have to get up and do this thing where you have dyslexia. You have to read out loud. So I, whenever I did auditions, I would always go, oh, I got to memorize it.
Right.
I did whatever I could do at the time until I literally realized, wait a minute, I just haven't spent enough time reading out loud. And really that cured my dyslexia, that cured my ADD, or I don't think I ever really had ADD, but you know, they were
certainly
ready to prescribe the Ritalin right away. Well, so, and by the way, I rejected Ritalin when I was a kid too.
Yeah, yeah.
There was something about it where I said to myself, you know, I would take the little pill, I'd go to the bathroom, and I'd put it in the toilet.
Right.
And then there came a day where I just said, Mom, I've never really taken the Ritalin because I don't want it to. This is like a little kid saying, I don't want it to mess with my brain, you know?
Yeah.
And my mom kind of got that. She was kind of like, by the way, my mother was not a very good student either.
Right.
And so she would always say, oh, I hated school too. It was like all the things that you talk about.
So I think the first thing that I, because I've had this, been having this conversation with people for the last, you know, 13 years, decade, right? So already I hear the angry YouTube comments. I can literally hear them. So I just want to be clear that, you know, certainly I'm not saying that dyslexia is not a thing or that dyslexia doesn't exist, right? There is, you know, there's a great book called Proust and the Squid, which is about dyslexia, right? But I think that the important thing to realize is that there's dyslexia, whatever that may be genetically. And then there's the fact that what ends up happening very often with, you know, kids who are diagnosed with anything is that what is a problem that is maybe this size becomes metastasized into a problem that is a giant, giant problem that now what's really going on are feelings of learned helplessness, right? Where you don't feel like you're in control, you can't help it, right? Feelings of shame, right? You feel stupid.
Yeah.
And that ultimately what ends up happening is, you know, that kids just say whatever. They tell themselves that school doesn't matter, school isn't for them, and then they focus their own energy elsewhere. Brian Callen had, you know, when we talked to Carol Dweck, you know, he has a story that he tells about, you know, when he got his IQ test. And it's amazing because I was, you know, and he said that he's like, I don't know what the results were, I don't know what it was, but like, I clearly got the idea that it was just, you know, average or that this wasn't for me or that I wasn't good at this thing. And I had this conversation with my mother because I've known, you know, Brian's family for a long time. And she's like, I remember that. Like it was, there was so much emotional stress and drama around that test that what ended up happening was, is that, you know, I mean, again, like, you know, this is where you have to really factor in this off the charts, what we know from Henrik about, you know, humanity's off the charts social intelligence. Kids are constantly tracking everything. They're picking up all those signals. And so you really have to think about what are the signals that you're sending. And, you know, I mean, there's a student who, you know, I'm working with right now who's a teenager. And, you know, he was diagnosed with dyslexia as a young kid. And, you know, that has essentially, you know, there's whatever the dyslexia was, but then there's the ways in which it has derailed him academically.
Yeah.
And
well, and I think that for me, it was, oh, I have learning disabilities and I reject school. And, you know, I'm not saying all dyslexia is created equal. I'm just saying in my own experience, I literally don't believe that I had any of the things that I was diagnosed with. What I did have was positive reinforcement of school's not for you, positive reinforcement of you have learning disabilities, you should take this pill, it'll make you think differently, it'll help you to focus.
Yeah.
When really, what I really needed was the strong desire to sit and read out loud kind of overcome a lot of the social pressures that were put on me. And, you know, try being 10 years old and articulating this. That's another thing.
Well, of course, as a 10-year-old, you don't have social power, right? Like, what 10-year-old gets to challenge a doctor at UCLA and say, I disagree with you?
Right.
No, you're going to lose that one.
Yep.
And then, you know, be, you know, I mean, what you're really trying to do is, and I mean, I think this is what's so interesting, is that the feeling is clear to you, right? Mm-hmm. But it takes a long time to find the words to describe that feeling. And that's so much of, you know, what mixed mental arts is about and what the Straight A Conspiracy was about, is giving people the words to say what they have felt for so long.
Yep.
And to give them the tools to have the credibility to be able to say these things in a way where they have to be heard, because they're like, I have the science.
They're life-changing.
They're life-changing.
When you learn, to learn, unlearn, and relearn.
Hey.
Okay. When you learn to do that,
swag alert, product placement alert.
That's also like, available as mugs and onesies.
Like, that's what I also love. Just as a shout out to Unikitty, Nicole
Did
Lee Page.
Did you say onesie?
Onesies. Oh. It's amazing. But this is what I love, is that Nicole Lee Page, Unikitty, who does a lot of this merchandise, is constantly like trying to drive the narrative that it's not just t-shirts and hoodies. It's also onesies, mugs, laptop covers. And I'm like, okay, I'm really, I have yet to see anyone buy a onesie, but you know, I suppose it's possible. But anyway, but when you know how to learn, unlearn, and relearn.
When you can apply these ideas to your real life, and when you can take interest in something and start the process of learning, you approach everything differently.
Yeah.
You know, the things that you can learn are limitless.
Yep.
And I think it's just like you say in your Straight A Conspiracy book, the fact that you can learn one thing does mean that you can learn anything.
Yep.
And
because learning is, and just to unpack that for people, because learning is about habits, it's about automaticity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and that's what is always so funny is that, you know, you pick any, like, this is the experience that Katie and I had repeatedly. We'd be like, you know, you have some kid who's convinced that they can't do something or that they're terrible at something. And then meanwhile, you go and you like, you know, they're like, phew, thank God this emotionally unpleasant session of whatever it is over, because now I'm going to go be world class at Guitar Hero.
Right.
And it's like, okay, fine, Guitar Hero, it's a thing that we don't respect or value in our society, but it took a shitload of fix-it-focused practice to get good at that. Mm-hmm. And that's all it takes to get good at anything, is a shitload of fix-it-focused practice.
And that, at least for me, mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that that wasn't taught. That wasn't ever articulated. Those ideas were not articulated to me when I was a kid in a way that I could understand.
They were not taught. I'm going to tell you right now, they were not taught.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of this comes out of the history of science and what was believed about intelligence for so long, mm-hmm. And what was taught and what was the messaging. And, you know, I mean, this is, you know, Kate Fogarty and I are going to be doing a series on IQ and how the IQ test was hijacked by Lewis Terman. As part of the eugenics movement. It was the IQ test. This is something that I think you'll really appreciate. So Alfred Binet was the guy who invented the IQ test. And Binet invented the IQ test to identify what children did well and didn't do well so that he could then provide targeted help to be like, oh, these are the holes in your mental game. Let me help you with this. Or, oh, you have holes in your mental game here. Let's provide targeted support for that. Right? And that's what it was originally for.
Sounds like a good idea.
Sounds like a really great idea. And then it was hijacked by Lewis Terman of the eugenics movement to be a measure of your fixed potential. And so Terman, you know, said, oh, based on this test, like, I can predict who's good and who's not and who's worthwhile and who will never be worthwhile. And he had this group of, he said, he took a, you know, group of children, he gave them IQ tests. Based on the IQ tests alone, he plucked out a group of kids and was like, these are the special kids. They called them his termites, right? Because Lewis Terman. And turns out that his pick was terrible. It wasn't very predictive at all. And in fact, you know, those, because you told those kids they were naturally smart, mm-hmm. right? That it actually fucked them up. Mm-hmm. And he missed out of the kids that he rejected. There were two Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. So it's a really terrible test. Anyway, but and if you guys want, you can go back and listen to episode 137 with Carol Dweck, where she really breaks down a lot of this. But she calls it the age of IQ, and it's mm-hmm. not particularly helpful. And when you say there's a story that I'm going to share with you that I think you'll really appreciate in terms of the worthlessness of these tests, right? And it's not that they have to be worthless, right? It's just that any test or any statistic has to be correctly interpreted. Mm-hmm. So when Binet is using the test, he's interpreting it as a measure of where kids are, not of what they can be, which is a huge, huge difference in interpretation. So a friend of mine from college, who I've tried to date three times, and just saying that, anybody who knows me will know who that is. But she this is at Harvard, so she goes and gets educational testing. And so she's getting educational testing from literally the best people in the world, right? Supposedly. And she takes this test, and there are these various sections on the test. And one of the sections is verbal matching, right, or whatever. And she's like, this is fun. Like, this is word problems. She enjoys it. She gets really into it. She goes through. She has great fun. And then she gets the reading comprehension passage. And it's like every SAT or ACT, you know, it's all the most boring passages possible. So she, like, starts, takes a look at them and is like, this is boring. I don't want to do this section. And then goes through and just bubbles in random answers. So the results come back. And this, you know, world-class educational psychologist says, you know, you are functionally retarded, right? She's like, you did really well on this verbal matching thing. But when it comes to reading comprehension, like, you should not be at Harvard. And you should really consider dropping out and going to an easier school, right? And that's because the test can't measure desire. It can't measure interest. It can't capture what people are feeling or why they're doing the things that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And it can't unpack that social history. It can't unpack that context. And so what it does is, you know, it's crucially any of these tests give us a snapshot. And, you know, it gives us a snapshot of what happened on that particular day in that testing room. But you get into huge problems when you then infer that snapshot as reflecting some underlying genetic reality, or when you think that that snapshot is predictive of what it's going to be in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's the point, is that, you know, any statistic needs to be interpreted. It needs to be made sense of. And, you know, when statistics, you know, Kathy O'Neill talks about weapons of math destruction. And a lot of these educational tests have been weapons of math destruction.
Yeah.
They've ruined a lot of lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I take it back to what Fresco says when he says you are a product of your environment.
Yeah.
And environment shapes behavior. And a lot of times we forget what environment really is. And to me, mm-hmm. what I believe he means by environment is everything that's happened to you from your little baby zygote epigenetically through every experience, through every dream.
Yeah.
And I oftentimes say, listen, I met a homeless person on the street when I was 20 who changed my life in a matter of a few minutes. So that's a big product of my overall environment, but it's just a very small fraction of my life. The same thing with the grades, you know, first grade, second grade, you know, these things, it was a small time in my life, but it affected so many decisions that I made down the line. And that's what environment is. And when I say environment shapes behavior, I'm saying not like just who your mom and dad are and like how much money they have and what religion you are. That's not your environment as a whole. That's an atomistic way to,
of course,
look at your environment.
Well, you know, and so much of what helps with this is metaphors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been working on the Culture Matters series, and Dave Colin, we were going to use the sort of Matrix red pill versus blue pill thing, but the red pill thing has been, you know, taken over by the men's rights activists. And it's a great metaphor, but it's problematic because mm-hmm. it comes with all sorts of connotations that you don't want. And, you know, is all
what
that
you're really
stuff.
Saying is break the illusion.
That's
you
right.
know, like the green screen behind us. Yeah. We just want to break the illusion.
It would be really cool if I went like this and then it sort of went, you know, the water ripple effect. No, but and I mean, you know, if this does end up being the Matrix dojo, uh-huh. then, you know, it would be appropriate to be talking about this.
Oh, that
but,
would be sweet. Yeah.
Okay. But the analogy that he came up with instead, which I think is actually even better, mm-hmm. is that it's, you know, asking if you're affected by your environment or asking if, you know, your culture shapes your choices is like asking if a fish is wet, right? You are, right? Like, a fish, does a fish know it's wet? Maybe a fish doesn't know it's wet because it's just like it's always lived in water. And so it's like, what water? What are you talking about? But the point is, it's very much the same thing. You know, and I think so many of us, I mean, I know for me, there's been this, I mean, you know, they call it, you know, waking up, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, consciousness raising or whatever it may be. And there is this process of really realizing the degree to which you're wet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, I think I'm wet, right? But then you're like, oh, fuck, I'm really wet. Like, I'm in a whole ocean of wetness, and I have always been in an ocean of wetness.
And I didn't even know it.
Yeah, and you didn't even know it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there is this process, and I mean, you know, we've all had various shamans who have ushered us into that knowledge.
Yeah.
And your shaman was Jacques the Love Machine Fresco.
Yeah,
right?
Jacques Love Master Fresco. And when I say that, the guy, you know, he gives you love.
Mm-hmm.
He just literally like looks at you with his, you know, 100-year-old eyes.
Yeah.
Judgment free. And for me, it was really eye opening to be able to spend so much time with him and to, you know,
be able to
work with him. And a lot of the stories that he tells, they're these wonderful, his life is like wonderful power, has wonderful parables in it.
Right.
Of, you know, just things that we can all learn from.
Right, and so, like, tell us, because you have that great story of him teaching you that you could draw.
Oh, my God. Okay, so that's one of them where, you know, he literally says to me, he goes, are you know how to draw? And I said, no, I'm not really a good artist. And he goes, well, draw something. And I said, okay. And he goes, okay, where's the horizon line? I said, what do you mean? What do you mean horizon line? He goes, oh, you really don't know anything. And I was like, he's like, all right, I'm going to teach you how to draw. So he started teaching me about composition. He started teaching me about horizon lines. He started mm-hmm. teaching me about vanishing points. And he said, I want you to practice, and I want you to practice with a ruler at first until you figure out which way the lines are supposed to go. Because mm-hmm. I didn't know which way the lines were supposed to go. And Jacques does happen to be an amazing artist.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say he's put in many, many hours.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Through drawing, what he taught me is that you want to be able to figure out what it is that you want to draw, and then you want to be able to figure out how to draw it from all different sides.
Right.
This is called perspective. Where do you want to put the camera? And so he started with teaching me how to draw with perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Always reminding me, by the way, there is no such thing as a good artist. There is nobody who's born learning how to draw. Nobody's born learning perspective or composition or where the horizon line goes.
Well, and crucially... Yeah, I think just to sort of really clarify that, right, these things were invented, right? Like, vanishing points were not a thing. You don't, it's no more complicated than going and looking at some art from ancient Greece on a vase, right? Like, they don't have vanishing points. They don't have any of that. And all of that starts to appear in, you know, I mean, my mother's the art historian, so she would maybe have this knowledge more at her fingertips, but the rest of us could Google it. But, you know, I'm going to go and just throw it out there and say it starts to appear with the Renaissance, right? And they start to figure out these different techniques, and they start to improve and refine these things. So we have the benefit, being in the 21st century, of humans already figured those things out.
Yes.
And so, you know, Jacques Fresco can then go and break it. You don't have to invent that. You mm-hmm. can learn it, and you can, you know, and you can, you know, get it pretty quickly. And I mean, the sort of the other sort of extreme of it is, you think about it, imagine that you and I were born in the 24th century of Star Trek: The Next Generation, right? You know, we would be way smarter than we are now because we would have access to, you know, Zefram Cochrane would have already invented the warp drive, and we would be able to, like, understand that and learn all those things. And it's not because our brains would be any different. We would just have the benefits of standing on the shoulders of more hobbits, more giants, and being able to see a little bit further because we're downloading more powerful cultural software.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I love about Jacques so much is that he will literally say, I know you think I'm a good artist,
mm-hmm.
but I've copied the best people.
Yeah.
I've copied their techniques. I'm not special. You know, neither are you.
Mozart.
And so
Mozart, you know, said the same thing. Mm-hmm. He says, you know, that there is scarcely a master in whose works I have not studied diligently and carefully. It's one of the quotes we have in the Straight Edge Conspiracy. So the point is, yeah, you steal like an artist. You steal from the best. And if you pull together all of these great things from lots of people and you make your brain an idea orgy.
Ooh.
Oh.
Gonna have to have a drink.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Andrew.
That sounds good.
But that's, I mean, that's
more than one.
More than one. But that is, I think, the fun is that, you know, I was talking to somebody today and I was saying, you know, I believe in fidelity in physical sex and promiscuity in idea sex.
Absolutely.
You know, you can have idea sex with anyone, anytime, unprotected. And, you know, you can just have as many ideas going into your brain. And the more you put in there, the more of an idea orgy your brain becomes and the more innovation there is. And, you know, that's the point of mixed mental arts is to, you know, offer that up to anybody who wants it.
Yeah.
And the more of us are doing it, the more exciting the world is going to become and the more innovation is going to be happening. And the sooner we can have
Kintsugi.
Kintsugi. But also, crucially, what my mother has always been asking for, every time I would watch Star Trek The Next Generation, she would be like, can I get a replicator? Can you go invent a replicator? So for my mother, some people want hoverboards. My mother wants a replicator. So, you know, let's all have idea orgies. And maybe out of some of those idea orgies, eventually will emerge a replicator for my mother.
Well, one of the things that Fresco also like points to is like, you know, he says that you can take these methods that he teaches you and apply them to anything that you want to learn. So I picked up a guitar for the first time when I was 15, and I've played, but a lot of times I play the same chord. I never really took formal lessons. I learned from my friends a little bit here, a little bit there. And so I would play the same chords over. I'd play A, you know, I'd play A, D, E, F, you know, G. I'd play the same kind of chords. And what Fresco would say was, if you want to get good at guitar, who are the guitarists that you love and learn what they do? So I was like, so my guitar playing's gotten better over the last 3 years because of the methodology that I've learned. So I've been playing since I was about 15.
Yeah.
But only over the last 3 years did I really start taking an interest in the applied method of learning, which is, okay, I'm going to start playing Slash because I really like the song Sweet Child of Mine. So, and by the way, when you start playing Slash, you go, holy fuck, this is hard.
Yeah.
This is going to take some time.
Yeah.
So then I start playing some Slash, and I start having a whole new found respect for Slash and the guitar genius that he is. So now my fingers move a little bit better because I can play Sweet Child of Mine, and I come up with my own little riff that I probably couldn't have come up with until before playing Slash.
Well, now, because you have to have automated those foundations in order to, like, when you automate things, right, that means that you no longer have to think about them. They're automatic, and so that frees up your attention to play. You can't do improv, jazz, until you have, like, mastered the fundamentals. Like, I can't sit in front of a piano and improvise because I literally don't. What do I have to draw on? There's nothing. You need a foundation. And obviously, I mean, this is for anybody who does mixed martial arts, right? Like, this is pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious that you need your fundamentals in place so that you can then play, right? And so that's the same thing for all learning. It all works in very much the same way.
Yeah,
And
it really does. You have to recognize, hey, if I'm taking on something new, I am going to suck.
Right.
And not only am I going to suck, I'm going to really suck, and I'm going to suck for a while.
Yeah,
and I'm going to suck for a while until I don't suck.
That's right. And you talked about when we had that now legendary, because we've talked about it so much, you know, like 3-4 hour conversation at the Coral Tree Cafe.
Yeah.
You talked about mat time.
Yeah.
So what? Tell me about mat time.
Mat time is the 10,000 hour principle, but I apply it to martial arts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to get good at martial arts, to get good at jiu-jitsu, you got to spend time on the mat. And it's very clear to everybody who's been on the mat that anybody, any body shape, any age can get good as long as they spend time on the mat.
That's right.
And you're going to go through major growth spurts of, you know, you're going to learn a lot of moves real quick. And then you're going to go, oh, I got someone in this and I got someone in that. And you're going to go through these growth spurts. And then you're going to, you know, have also times where you feel like you plateau and you go, oh, man, I can't get past where I am. I just can't. But the key is to not stop. The key is to just go, okay, I'm plateauing. I'm going to spend more time on the mat because
that's right.
As you kind of progress, and this is something that Fresco kind of points out too, is that as you progress, you just have to have this consistency.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes to feel the difference between getting good and getting great takes a longer stretch time, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, there's like the when you go from not being able to play any piece of music, right, to being able to play one piece of music. Well, that's a clear, trackable difference. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a long slog between being able to, you know, play some music to being Slash.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
And for a long time, you know, you're just sort of in that middle area, and it can feel like, you know, am I really getting closer to that? How much closer to that am I getting?
It can feel like a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And when there's a reason, I mean, you know, crucially, the 10,000 hour rule, people mm-hmm. get hung up on the exact number, mm-hmm. but just interpret the 10,000 hour rule as a fuck ton.
Yeah.
It takes a fuck ton of practice to get good at anything.
It really does. It takes a lot of mat time. And yeah. And jiu-jitsu is such a great metaphor for this because literally, the more time you spend on the mat, the more you realize any body type, any gender, any, you know what I mean? It's anything. As long as they're spending the time, they're going to get good and they're going to be better than the new guy.
Yep.
You know?
And we can just take mat time and we can add in after mat in parentheses an H. Because mat time, math time, it's all the same thing.
Oh!
You know, it just, that's the point. It doesn't, whatever the skill is, it doesn't matter. Like, yeah. It just takes a certain amount of time. You have to, in John Aguilar's words, embrace the suck, right?
That's, well, in other words, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. Embrace the suck, love the suck.
That's right.
Know that you're gonna suck. Because if you don't know that you're gonna suck, and you suck, it's a lot more disappointing than knowing you're going to suck. You start telling yourself these lies like, oh, I'm not meant to do this.
That's right.
I'm just not meant to do this thing that I want to do.
Right.
It's too bad I wasn't born with the gene.
Yeah.
And then you go on about your life and, you know.
And that I wasn't born with the gene is, you know, though, I mean, it's probably not going to be an actual genetic description. It's going to be the fundamental attribution error at work where you have confused, you know, your current performance for something about you inherently, like I'm this kind of person.
Yeah.
And so.
And it's a tragedy. And it really is a tragedy because I, much like Brian Callen, I look back on my life and I go, oh man, if I would have known this stuff when I was young, I would have been a killer.
Well, that's true for all of us. I mean, you know, the Katie and I have always said we wrote The Straight A Conspiracy because it was the book we'd wished we'd had in high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's our job in terms of cultural evolution, right? Like when the 24th century rolls around and, you know, Zephyrin Cochran has had his thing, you know, like the whole point is that these things that we're talking about now that were such profound revelations for us, our job is to make sure that that is the starting point for the next generation and for future generations so that they are starting knowing these things. They're starting knowing that humanity's superpower is its social intelligence and understanding how to learn, unlearn, and relearn. And when every human is starting from that position, we're going to have a very different and a much better world.
Yeah. Well, and that's why what the Mixed Mental Arts podcast is doing is so important, and it tugs on my heartstrings anytime you guys talk about it, because it literally is, I can't help but think, I wish I did learn this younger, and I feel it's my duty now that I do know and I do possess these skills to teach as many people as I can, to talk about it as openly and honestly as I can.
Yep.
You know, whatever you think about dyslexia or ADD or, you know, whatever you've been told, you know, it might be a little different for everybody, but from my perspective, from my experience, it was something that was certainly overcomable. And it took, you know, quite a bit of work and reflection on my own life to be able to do it. And my hope is that to be a teacher, mm-hmm. from the teacher perspective, I can sit and I could get people to where I am a little bit faster.
Yep. And that's the goal. And I mean, it you know, that will take a global village. It's going to take a lot of people to do that. And I think that the key thing, and this sort of really comes down to something that, you know, I've been thinking about a lot, and, you know, here's this great place to talk about it, which is, you know, everybody has a story, right? And there are all these shattered pieces of our lives. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the work of your life, especially when you start to become adult, is to make kintsugi out of those broken pieces of your life.
Yeah.
So how do you take whatever experiences it was that you had and make them useful? So rather than, you know, this experience of I wish I'd known that, right, that now becomes a super useful tool in storytelling,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it's like, I was here. I thought this thing because I was told these things by my parents and by my society and by the doctors at UCLA, and now I'm going to use that to go.
It was positively reinforced by That's my right. entire environment.
That's right. And so now the point is that that gives you the credibility to be able to talk about these things, because I had this experience. I remember these thinking these things, and I can't say what is true for every human,
right.
but I can tell you what my experience was. And that in the end is really what starts to change things, is when people start saying, this was my experience. And the point is that I think that you talking about this, that a lot of people are going to hear this and being like, that was me. I mean, Katie's, you know, the moment we were just sort of trying to solve this problem with the straight A conspiracy, but the moment for Katie when it really sort of became clear that we were doing something big and important mm-hmm. was when she sent the first few chapters home to her parents to read. She didn't think much about it, but then her father read them and said, that's me, Kate. Like, that was me, that kid. Like, mm-hmm. I was the kid who was sitting there and other people understood what was going on and I didn't understand why and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of people out there like, you know, David O'Brien or Andrew Hunt.
Yep.
And, you know, I may have done well in terms of the sciences, but I didn't get English. I didn't get punctuation or why it happened. Like, the joke that Katie and I always talk about is that, you know, I thought of commas like sprinkles, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. you wrote your paper and then afterwards, sprinkles! You just erase some commas with the paper. Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes the teacher liked it and then it was like, oh, teacher didn't like my sprinkles, but they liked that other person, right? Because... Yeah. The point is that, yeah, kids don't understand why things are happening.
Yeah.
And our job as adults is to go in there and help them make sense of why it's happening. And the problem is that, you know, this is sort of the real tragedy of the last 50, 60 years, is that after World War II, there was such a nervousness about, you know, telling people what to think, because there had been these big mass movements where, you know, we'd sort of all gotten swept up in, you know, saying this is the definitive way of thinking or this is the way of the world. And so very often children were just sort of left to form their own conclusions, right? And, you know, what that really meant was that very often people were essentially having to reinvent the wheel on some very, very basic things.
Yeah.
And, yeah, now we have the internet and we can move these ideas and everyone can have a voice and everyone can tell their story. And in many ways, right? Like, I mean, one of the cool things with the straight A conspiracy was, you know, we got contacted by this guy in Oklahoma who started, you know, giving all these copies away to prisoners. And, you know, that's like the Andrew Hunt experience times 10,000,
yeah.
right? Like, I wish I'd known this earlier, otherwise mm-hmm. I wouldn't be in prison. But for those guys or for any of these guys, like, the fact that you had that experience and have all those broken pieces, that's what really is going to make your kintsugi so powerful. Like, that story is going to be even more powerful. So that's the point. Everybody has a voice now, so share it. Tell yeah. your story.
Yeah.
And that's how you change the world, is by enough people telling their story.
Yeah. And, you know, Fresco always says, if you don't think you can change the world, that just means you're one of the ones who won't.
Yeah.
You know, so when he helped kind of it's almost like a reformatting of your brain. Mm-hmm. When you learn these.
Oh, it is.
You know, how to learn, unlearn, relearn. When you learn about atomism and holism, when you learn about a lot of the things that you're talking about, Descartes' error, when you start learning about these things, it changes your whole life perspective. And I really do feel like it's for the benefit of all people.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why it is important to push these ideas. It's yep. important to get these ideas out. Otherwise, you know, you do live in sort of an illusion that you just tell yourself, oh, I'm not meant to do this or I'm not meant to do that.
Yeah.
And it's really just too bad, because when you start to live in this type of way with, you know, when you start applying this to your life, you really go, oh, well, the world really is my oyster. I really That's can right. do anything that I want to do. And then you just start gauging. Then the next trick is to just start gauging, how much time do I have to put into X, Y, and Z? How bad do I really want it? how good do I really want to get? And I think that's one of the great things that you're doing with this is
that
you're,
we're doing
that we're doing with this is that you literally taking these ideas and consciously saying, okay, well, it took me 5 years and a whole lot of introspective thought to figure this stuff out. How can I relay this to a 12-year-old in a lot less time than it took me?
That's right. And it's about collapsing down teaching time, right? Mm-hmm. And the clearer and clearer these ideas get, the less and less time it's going to take to convey them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, the great thing is that so much of this is that I'm well aware that what we have to do is really just, you know, get the wisdom of crowds going,
yeah.
Right? Like, it's the ideas are there. They've been, a lot of them, they've been, you know, piled up in many, siloed in many areas. And we have to start to bring them together to start getting the waters of the internet churning in the right direction.
Yeah.
So that everybody, rather than saying no, but, is figuring out, you know, it's a yes, and we start building that pyramid of hobbits from all of these ideas. And once that starts, you know, that's just going to become a virtuous cycle. And it's just going to build and build and build and build. And, you know, crucially, it's people are going to do it for a whole bunch of different reasons. Like, yeah. That's the great thing. Some people will take these ideas and use it to try and, you know, humiliate or defeat their enemies. And they will move these ideas for us, mm-hmm. right? Some people will do it because, you know, oh, I really just want to help my particular, you know, grandkid, or I really just want to, like, you know, change my own life or get ahead, or some young guy who's like, oh, I want to show off at parties and impress people with how smart I am, or I want to be more financially successful and get laid more. Doesn't really matter, you know, or, you know, I want to change the way that women are treated in the society so that I have to raise cultural awareness. I have to make people reflective, right? So people are going to do it for a whole bunch of different reasons.
Yep.
Doesn't matter why people are doing it. The point is to get the ideas moving. And as the ideas start to move, then the wisdom of crowds will more and more sort through these things.
Absolutely.
And then you're going to start to really see Spirit of 76, motherfucker.
What?
And that's how the Callan Fate is built. Why don't we end it out with, you know, very kindly, Andrew has a copy of Jacques Fresco's book, The Best That Money Can't Buy.
Yes.
It has been autographed.
It has been autographed by the co-founders of the Venus Project, Jacques Fresco and Roxanne Meadows.
Mm-hmm.
And
Andrew would like to give it away.
I would.
And, you know, we were thinking of, like, you know, there's this one book and 7.5 billion humans, all of whom listen to Mixed Mental Arts / The Brian Callan Show. So who do we give it to? And what I thought might be fun, right, is that it will give the book away to whoever best expresses the thing that is the best that money can't buy. So what is the best that money can't buy, right? And, you know, you could go funny with this, you can go serious, you can go sincere, you know, what is that to you? You can do it visually, you can do it with a song, you can do it with music. Whoever best expresses that idea, this book is yours.